This is the sixth day of this November 2010 seven-day session. And we're going to take up another koan today. This is one from the Mumon Khan, which has 48 cases, each with a commentary and verse. This is number 47, and it's called Tosatsu's Three Barriers. I'll begin by reading the case. Tosatsu set up three barriers to test his monks. To inquire after the truth, groping your way through the underbrush, is for the purpose of seeing into your self nature. At this moment, where is your nature? Second, when you realize your nature, you are free from life, free from death. When the light of your eyes is falling, how can you be free from life and death? And third, when you are free from life and death, you know where you will go. When the four elements separate, where are you off to? We do have some biographical material on Tosatsu. His Chinese name is Dao Shuai. I'm going to use the Japanese in this case. It's not just that I can't pronounce Chinese names correctly, the way a Chinese would recognize it, but also I think most of us find the sounds of Chinese names elusive, difficult to hold in the mind, or the Japanese a little less difficult. So his dates, Tosatsu, were 1044 to 1091. So he only lived to be 48. He studied both the Theravada and the Mahayana schools of Buddhism. He was ordained when he was 15 as a monk. I'm going to turn to another source. Now, it's called Zen Dust. And this used to be, until a few years ago, or maybe 8 years ago, this used to be the definitive source of biographical material on the masters, and then an even fuller text came out, which we usually read from Zen's Chinese Heritage. Reading now from Zen Dust. He studied under several masters consecutively, for though he had a brilliant mind, his conceit made it difficult for him to accept authority. It says, finally, though, the sharp criticism given to him by a certain master, I won't clutter up the Teisho with all these names, a certain master caused Tosatsu to reconsider his attitude. he became the head monk at a certain monastery, and on one occasion he led a group of monks on a journey to visit another Zen master. His name was Yungay. After only a few sentences of conversation, Yungay knew that Tosatsu possessed special ability. Yungay laughed and said, "I see that your breath is unusual. Why is it that when you speak, your breath is like that of a drunkard?" Tosatsu's face became flushed and he broke out in a sweat. And he said, "I hope the master won't spare your compassion." And then Yungay continued to talk to Tosatsu, goading him. Tosatsu was flustered and he didn't understand and know what to do, and he asked to have a private meeting with the master. In the abbot's room, Yungay asked Tosatsu, "Have you ever seen Zen master so-and-so?" Tosatsu said, "I've read the record of his talks. I understood it all, so I don't want to see him." Tosatsu said, "Have you seen Zen master Dongshan?" Tosatsu said, "His disciples don't have any brains. If you put on a cotton garment that smells like piss, what good is it?" Yungay said, "You should go and practice at that place that smells like piss." Following Yungay's instructions, Tosatsu went and practiced with Zen master Wenhe and deeply realized his great teaching. Later, Tosatsu returned to see Zen master Yungay. Yungay said, "Now that you've seen Guangxi's disciples, what about the great matter?" And Tosatsu said, "Had it not been for your instruction, it would have slipped past me my entire life." And then he bowed in gratitude. Now, I don't know if it was after then or before then. I couldn't untangle these two different biographical accounts, but it doesn't really matter so much. Here's another account from Tosatsu's life. One day an old monk came to the mountain. He was over 80 years old and had been a personal disciple of the great Sekiso. The old monk told Tosatsu that though he had been under Sekiso for 13 years and had reached his present advanced age, he would not dare teach others. He severely criticized this other teacher, saying that his followers too quickly left their teacher and set themselves up in the world as masters before their practice was sufficient. The old monk's remarks struck home, and after some reflection, Tosatsu asked permission to become his disciple. Under the old monk, Tosatsu now devoted himself again to practice and later received Inca from this old monk. Maybe that was Yungay. Sorry that I didn't get this straightened, but they're all these different names. One person can have two or three or four different names depending on not only the Chinese and the Japanese, but the different times of their practice. They take different names. Now, after he became a master, Tosatsu entered the hall and addressed the monks and said, "When a person's eyes and ears are clear, then he resides in a remote mountain valley. The autumn wind rustles the ancient pines, and the autumn moon reflects from the cold waters. A monk who reaches that place must go still further to realize the truth, for this is still just two apes with four tails hanging down." Whatever that means. After saying this, the master shouted. So this is the central warning in Zen about not resting in emptiness, not resting in the bliss and the serenity of an empty mind. Going on beyond that. This is especially important to keep in mind late in Sesshin when people can sometimes find themselves in this realm of no thought, absolute stillness. But that stillness is a conditioned state, and when conditions change, it subsides, it disappears. Tosatsu addressed the monks, saying, "First comes the new spring, and then it's the beginning of summer. The four seasons pass like an arrow. The sun and moon move like a shuttle. Before you know it, a red-faced baby has turned into an old white hare. You must truly exert yourself and use extraordinary effort. Cultivate your own field and don't steal someone else's seedlings. Applying yourself in this way, your practice will certainly result in finally seeing the white ox on Snow Mountain." When he was 48, after bathing, the master assembled the monks and recited this verse. "After 48 years, sacred and mundane are completely killed off. Although not heroic, the Longgang road is slippery." Longgang is the area, the name of the area where he lived. Sacred and mundane are completely killed off. All dualisms. The Longgang road is slippery. He may be referring to his own journey. That's all the material we have about Tosatsu. Now, back to the case. This is considered one of the very most important of all the koans. In some traditions, this is done near the very end of the whole collection of hundreds of koans, but it does appear here near the end of the Mumonkan. So here and many other centers, it's taken in the order where it's not even halfway through all the koans. It's important, of course, because it deals with the fundamental matter. This matter we are reminded of on the wooden block that hangs at Arnold Park, and as it does at many other Zen centers and temples, on which is inscribed, "Great is the matter of birth and death. Life slips quickly by. Time waits for no one. Wake up, wake up. Don't waste a moment." The matter of birth and death, life and death, is really at the very heart of Zen practice. not everyone who comes to practice has this consciously in their mind as their motivation, their struggle with this matter of death. Personally, I think it's always lurking there in everyone, because to be in a human body mind is to know that we will die someday. Is to know the certainty of death and the uncertainty of the time of death. And knowing this is the fundamental predicament of human existence. We're alive now. Someday we will be gone. I think this fear of death is what one writer, translator of Buddhist texts and editor of Buddhist books, his name is Edward Kanze, was referring to when he said the following. According to the views elaborated by Scheler, Freud, Heidegger, and Jaspers, there is in the core of our being a basic anxiety, a little empty hole from which all other forms of anxiety and unease draw their strength. In its pure form, this anxiety is experienced only by people with an introspective and philosophical turn of mind, and even then, only rarely. If one has never felt it oneself, no amount of explanation will convince. If one has felt it, one will never forget, however much one may try. It may come upon you when you have been asleep, withdrawn from the world. You wake up in the middle of the night and feel a kind of astonishment at being there, which then gives way to a fear and horror at the mere fact of being there. It is then that you catch yourself by yourself, just for a moment, against the background of a kind of nothingness all around you, and with a gnawing sense of your powerlessness, your utter helplessness in the face of this astonishing fact that you are there at all. Usually we avoid this experience as much as we possibly can because it is so shattering and painful. Usually I am very careful not to have myself by myself, but the I plus all sorts of other experiences. People who are busy all the time, who must always think of something, who must always be doing something, are incessantly running away from this experience of the basic or original anxiety. What we usually do is to lean and to rely on something else than this empty center of ourselves. The Buddhist contention is that we will never be at ease before we have overcome this basic anxiety, and that we can do that only by relying on nothing at all. When he says this horror at the mere fact of being, because, of course, awareness of being comes with awareness of eventual not being. A Buddhist master put it very neatly. That which is not dear to me will not be, that which is dear to me will not be, and I will not be, and all will not be. What we call fear of death is fear of being or not being. The two go together. And we human beings have many ways of reacting to this fear of not being, fear of death. Some general categories we can mention. I once heard that men tend to react to fear with a compulsive effort to conquer it, whereas women are more inclined to simply dodge it, to get away from it. There's some truth to that at times. I know when I, after going skydiving when I was in college, years later after coming to Sachin, I realized that was just an effort to conquer my own fear of death. I wonder how many young men and women now go to war to conquer their fear of death. Some people use humor. Woody Allen does a lot with the whole matter of death. Lily Tomlin, another comedian, said, "There will be sex after death. We just won't be able to feel it." Carl Jung, I once heard, more than once, Roshi Kaplow used to say this, that Carl Jung, when his practice of psychoanalysis was mature, said that he had never met a patient over the age of 40 for whom the underlying fear was not fear of death. The underlying problem was not the fear of death. Maybe this is why I think of a movie called Moonstruck with Cher and Olympia Dukakis. And Olympia Dukakis was playing the long-suffering wife of a guy who was always having affairs with other women. And in the recent one that's shown in the movie, she finds out about it in anguish. She's wringing her hands, literally wringing her hands, crying out, "Why do men cheat on their wives?" And then she had this light bulb gone over her head, and her face softened with understanding, and she said, "Because they're afraid to die." They've done surveys. Psychologists have done surveys asking people what their greatest fears are, and the fear of death didn't come out number one. Fear of death was number two. Number one was fear of public speaking. But consider that. What is that? Of course, it is fear of dying, just not physically dying. It's fear of humiliation, which is dying. What is dying? The self, our image of ourself, that we spend our lives trying to preserve and coat and defend is threatened in public speaking. That's what so many people think. That we're going to suffer some loss of face, loss of pride, if we fail before others. It's fear of death. Other research shows that what people report is not fear of death per se, but fear of dying, fear of the process of dying. Where does this fundamental anxiety stem from? It stems from, of course, from thoughts, notions. The notion, first of all, that there is some self, some entity, some fixed, permanent entity that is subject to dying. That's the fundamental misunderstanding. But also, then, in one's mind, through concepts, dividing living and dying. Life and death. And that's a false division. Living is dying, isn't it? With birth, we begin dying. But more than that, living is change. It's flux. We in Buddhism we speak of two kinds of death or dying. One is the regular kind that most people think of as death and dying, or it could be called corporeal, the death of the body. But then there's also what can be called continuous birth and death, which now we have confirmed quite some while now through medical science, that our bodies are continuously going through a process of dying and being reborn. The cells are in constant flux. This is dying. This is living. A very, very good analogy is used in Buddhism for this non-dual nature of living and dying, and that is of a candle. A candle, the burning of the candle, is also its dying. Its living is its dying. Coming, facing one's fundamental existential anxiety, the fear of death, is the best possible way to begin practice. As a Chinese proverb, discipline begins with the fear of death. How many people have finally gotten serious about exercise, when they get some worrisome medical report, how many people have finally got serious about diet, watching their diet as a result of getting some alarming news. Not everyone has to get such alarming medical news. Some people have this at quite a young age. Many of the masters we read about began with this fear of dying. Hakuin comes to mind. He was terrified of dying as a young man. What a painful thing to have to live with, this fear. And spiritually speaking, what a blessing. Awful as it is, awful, awful. What a blessing to have this, to fuel one's practice. All right, first barrier. To inquire after the truth, groping your way through the underbrush, is for the purpose of seeing into your self nature. At this moment, where is your nature? Each one of these barriers calls for the student to demonstrate her or his understanding in Doksan. Physically, demonstrate. Inquire after the truth. Where have I come from? Where will I go after I die? What am I doing here? What am I doing here? What is this all for? What is Mu? What am I? What is this? Groping your way through the underbrush. Another translation has it as through the grass. They both stand for this wild, unruly nature of the mind, with all of its snarl of thoughts and notions, fears. The wonderful thing about questioning is that it is a kind of dying. How so? How is questioning dying? Because it is relinquishing our grip on our thoughts. You can't hold on to your thoughts and question at the same time. Not really question. Questioning is letting go. Letting go is dying. This is why questioning is such a vital element of koan practice. If one can tap into one's fundamental questions and bring forth this questioning energy and lash it to the koan, then it can move mountains. Because while questioning, we are in a state of non-abiding, non-attachment. You can't wonder about something while clinging to your opinions or your ideas. second barrier. When you realize your nature, you are free from life, free from death. When the light of your eyes is falling, how can you be free from life and death? It's talking, of course, about dying well. In Sesshin, we learn to die. It's not only through questioning, but it's any time that we are letting go of our thoughts, we're dying. The self is just a cluster of thoughts, of images, memories. That's all it is. Where's the self? Who can point to an unchanging self, an entity? Each one of us is change. We are change. There's no little man in here, no little woman in there. What seems to be a self is just a habit thought, a certain notion that has solidified over our lifetime, from the time we could first learn vocabulary. So when we are letting go of thoughts, we're letting go of self. It's dying. In the course of this dying that we do in our meditation, we have a number of phenomena that get kicked up. Makyo, hallucinations, fears, other reactions. We're in a transition. The Tibetans call it transition bardo. Sesshin is bardo. Have you wondered? Surely you have. Everyone has. Have you wondered how you might meet death? How you're going to die? Just look. How are you dying when you're facing the wall? Are you clinging? Ah, that's painful. That resistance is what makes it so awful. Dying is living. It's only when we learn to die that we can really be fully alive. This is why people come back to Sesshin, in spite of all the pain and the loneliness and the lack of sleep and everything else that makes Sesshin so challenging. Why do we keep coming back? Because we know, somehow we know, that this is true living. This is living on the edge. This is the marrow, the juice of life. Is living without being bound up in thoughts. Direct experience. Just pure direct experience. More or less, depending on how much we cling to our thoughts. Many veterans have written that they, after coming back from battle, that life was just never the same. That not just in terms of what they suffered, but in terms of the vividness of their life back home as compared to in battle, in war. It's astonishing. So many veterans yearn to get back to that, back to battle. Where the self is at risk. We want to be free of the self. When I was much younger, I studied with a teacher who was very good at coming forth with certain aphorisms that had a symmetry to them and a cleverness at the same time. He once said, "Woman bears life, man bears death." We know that that's maybe all right as far as it goes, but it goes beyond that. But still, when a woman is bearing a child, she's dying, isn't she? She's giving up her life as a non-parent. When we struggle with death and dying in the best way, as we do in Sesshin, relinquishing, this is living. Third barrier, when you are free from life and death, you know where you will go. When the four elements separate, where are you off to? The four elements is just the traditional Chinese way of describing the body as consisting of fire, earth, air, and water. And then it goes, it's in other cultures too. Where are you off to? When you are free, you know where you will go. Aitken Roshi tells a story of visiting one of his students who was near death in a hospital, and when he took her hand, she said, "Roshi, where am I going?" And he said, "Wherever your toes lead you." And she brightened at that. And he said that she died peacefully just minutes later. The Buddha was once asked, by a follower, "What will I be in my next life?" He said, "If you want to know," or maybe it was a past life. Anyway, what he said was, "If you want to know what you were in the past, look at yourself now. If you want to know what you'll be in the future, look at yourself now." When Thoreau was on his deathbed, he was asked by the minister, "Can you see the other shore?" And he replied, "One world at a time." These transcendentalists, they had it together. And then the commentary. If you can rightly give the three turning words here, you will be master wherever you may be and live up to the Dharma in all situations. If, however, you have not resolved the matter yet, I warn you, the food you bolt won't sustain you. Chew it well and you won't be hungry. Don't settle for some light, partial experiences of insight. Keep chewing, keep chewing. Don't let up. And the verse, this one instant as it is the whole of eternity. The whole of eternity is at the same time this one instant. If you see into this fact, the one who is seeing has been seen into. This too, the student has to demonstrate in Doksan. This one instant as it is the whole of eternity. The whole of eternity is at the same time this one instant. That's when seer and seen merge. Subject and object break down. We realize there is just this. Time is up. We'll stop and recite the four vows.